Side 10. Christine. Continuing on page 371. He's a donkey, Arnie thought. She talks to him like a donkey, she rides him like a donkey, and he brays like a donkey. You're smiling again, Regina said. I was just thinking about how much I love you both, Arnie said. His father looked at him, surprised and touched. There was a soft gleam in his mother's eyes that might have been tears. They really believed it, the shitters. By 3 o'clock that Christmas Eve, the snow was still only isolated flurries, although the flurries were beginning to blend into each other. The delay in the storm's arrival was not good news, the weather forecasters said. It had compacted itself and turned even more vicious. Predictions of possible accumulations had gone from a foot to a possible 18 inches, with serious drifting and high winds. Lee Cabot sat in the living room of her house, across from a small natural Christmas tree that was already beginning to shed its needles. In her house, she was the voice of traditionalism, and for 4 years had successfully staved off her father's wish for a synthetic tree and her mother's wish to kick off the holiday season with a goose or a capon instead of the traditional Thanksgiving turkey. She was alone in the house. Her mother and father had gone over to the Stewarts for Christmas Eve drinks. Mr. Stewart was her father's new boss, and they liked each other. This was a friendship Mrs. Cabot was eager to promote. In the last 10 years they had moved 6 times, hopping all over the eastern seaboard, and of all the places they had been, her mom liked Libertyville the best. She wanted to stay here, and her husband's friendship with Mr. Stewart could go a long way toward ensuring that. All alone and still a virgin, she thought. That was an utterly stupid thing to think. But all the same, she got up suddenly, as if stung. She went into the kitchen, overconscious of that Formica Wonderland's little servo sounds, electric clock, the oven where a ham was baking. Turn that off at 5 if they're not back, she reminded herself. A cool clunk from the freezer as the Frigidaire's ice maker made another cube. She opened the fridge, saw a 6-pack of Coke sitting in there next to Daddy's beer, and thought, "Get thee behind me, Satan." Then she grabbed a can anyway, never mind what it did to her complexion. She wasn't going with anyone now. If she broke out, so what? The empty house made her uneasy. It never had before. She'd always felt pleased and absurdly competent when they left her alone. A holdover from childhood days, no doubt. The house had always seemed comforting to her. But now the sounds of the kitchen, of the rising wind outside, even the scuff of her slippers on the linoleum, these sounds seemed sinister, even frightening. If things had worked out differently, Arnie could have been here with her. Her folks, especially her mother, had liked him, at first. Now, of course, after what had happened, her mother would probably wash her mouth out with soap if she knew Lee was even thinking of him. But she did think of him, too much of the time, wondering why he had changed, wondering how he was taking the breakup, wondering if he was okay. The wind rose to a shriek and then fell off a little, reminding her, for no reason, of course, of a car's engine revving and then falling off. "Won't come back from Dead Man's Curve," her mind whispered strangely. And for no reason at all, of course, she went to the sink and poured her Coke down the drain and wondered if she was going to cry or throw up or what. She realized with dawning surprise that she was in a state of low terror. For no reason at all, of course. At least her parents had left the car in the garage. Cars, she had cars on the brain. She didn't like to think of her dad trying to drive home from the Stewarts in this, half-soused from 3 or 4 martinis, except that he always called them martoonies with typical adult kittenishness. It was only 3 blocks, and the two of them had left the house bundled up and giggling, looking like a couple of large children on their way to make a snowman. The walk home would sober them up. It would be good for them. It would be good for them if... The wind rose again, gunning around the eaves and then falling off. And she suddenly saw her mother and father walking up the street through clouds of blowing snow, holding on to each other to keep from falling on their drunken, lovable asses, laughing. Daddy may be goosing Mom through her snow pants. The way he sometimes goosed her when he got a buzz on was also something that had always irritated Lee, precisely because it seemed such a juvenile thing for a grown man to do. But, of course, she loved them both. Her love was a part of the irritation, and her occasional exasperation with them was very much a part of her love. They were walking together through a snow as thick as heavy smoke, and then two huge green eyes opened in the white behind them, seeming to float, eyes that looked terribly like the circles of the dashboard instruments she had seen as she was choking to death, and they were growing, stalking her helpless, laughing, squiffy parents. She drew a harsh breath and went back into the living room. She approached the telephone, almost touched it, then veered away and went back to the window, looking out into the white and cupping her elbows in the palms of her hands. What had she been about to do? Call them? Tell them she was alone in the house and had gotten thinking about Arnie's old and somehow slinking car, his steel girlfriend, Christine, and that she wanted them to come home because she was scared for them and herself? Was that what she was going to do? Cutely cute. The plowed blacktop of the street was disappearing under new snow, but slowly. It had only just begun to snow really hard, and the wind periodically tried to clear the street with strong gusts that sent membranes of powder twisting and rising to merge with the whitish-gray sky of the stormy afternoon, like slowly twisting smoke ghosts. Oh, but the terror was there. It was real. And something was going to happen. She knew it. She had been shocked to hear that Arnie had been arrested for smuggling. But that reaction had been nowhere as strong as the sick fear she had felt when she opened the paper on an earlier day and saw what had happened to Buddy Repperton and those other two boys, that day when her first crazy, terrible, and somehow certain thought had been Christine. And now the premonition of some new piece of black work hung heavily on her, and she couldn't get rid of it. It was crazy. Arnie had been in Philadelphia at a chess tourney. She had asked around that day. That was all there was to it. And she would not think about this anymore. She would turn on all the radios, the TV, fill the house up with sound, not think about that car that smelled like the grave, that car that had tried to kill her, murder her. Oh, damn, she whispered. Can't you quit? Her arms sculpted rigidly in goose flesh. Abruptly, she went to the telephone again, found the phone book, and as Arnie had done on an evening some 2 weeks before, she called Libertyville Community Hospital. A pleasant-voiced receptionist told her that Mr. Gilder had been checked out that morning. Lee thanked her and hung up. She stood, thoughtful, in the empty living room, looking at the small tree, the presents, the manger in the corner. Then she looked up the Gilder's number in the phone book and dialed it. "Lee," Dennis said, happily pleased. The phone in her hand felt cold. "Dennis, can I come over and talk to you?" "Today?" he asked, surprised. Confused thoughts tumbled through her mind. The ham in the oven. She had to turn the oven off at 5. Her parents would be home. It was Christmas Eve. The snow. And she didn't think it would be safe to be out tonight, out walking on the sidewalks when anything might come looming out of the snow. Anything at all. Not tonight. That was the worst. She didn't think it would be safe to be out tonight. "Lee?" "Not tonight," she said. "I'm house-sitting for my folks. They're at a cocktail party." "Yeah, mine too," Dennis said, amused. "My sister and I are playing Parcheesi. She cheats." Faintly. "I do not." At another time, it might have been funny. It wasn't now. "After Christmas, maybe on Tuesday, the 26th, would that be all right?" "Sure," he said. "Lee, is it about Arnie?" "No," she said, clutching the telephone so tightly that her hand felt numb. She had to struggle with her voice. "No, not Arnie. I want to talk to you about Christine." 42. The storm breaks. "Well, she's a hot-stepping henny with a 4 on the floor. She's a roadrunner engine in a 32 Ford. Yeah, late at night when I'm dead on the line, I swear I think of your pretty face when I let her wind. Well, look over yonder. See those city lights? Come on, little darling, go ramrodding tonight." Bruce Springsteen. By 5 o'clock that evening, the storm had blanketed Pennsylvania. It screamed across the state from border to border, its howling throat full of snow. There was no final Christmas Eve rush, and most of the weary and shell-shocked clerks and salespeople were grateful to Mother Nature, in spite of the mist overtime. There would, they told each other over Christmas Eve drinks in front of freshly kindled fires, be plenty of that when returns started on Tuesday. Mother Nature didn't seem all that motherly that evening, as early dusk gave way to full dark, and then to blizzardy night. She was a pagan, fearsome old witch that night, a harridan on the wind. And Christmas meant nothing to her. She ripped down Chamber of Commerce tinsel and sent it gusting high into the black sky. She blew the large nativity scene in front of the police station into a snowbank, where the sheep, the goats, the Holy Mother and Child were not found until a late January thaw uncovered them. And as a final spit in the eye of the holiday season, she tipped over the 40-foot tree that had stood in front of the Libertyville Municipal Building and sent it through a big window and into the town tax assessor's office. A good place for it, Nanny said later. By 7 o'clock, the plows had begun to fall behind. A trailways bus bowled its way up Main Street at 7:15, a short line of cars dogging its silvery rump like puppies behind their mother. And then the street was empty, except for a few slant-parked cars that had already been buried to the bumpers by the passing plows. By morning, most of them would be buried entirely. At the intersection of Main Street and Basin Drive, a stop-and-go light that directed no one at all twisted and danced from its power cable in the wind. There was a sudden electrical fizzing noise, and the light went dark. Two or three passengers from the last city bus of the day were crossing the street at the time. They glanced up and then hurried on. By 8 o'clock, when Mr. and Mrs. Cabot finally arrived home, to Lee's great but unspoken relief, the local radio stations were broadcasting a plea from the Pennsylvania State Police for everyone to stay off the roads. By 9 o'clock, as Michael, Regina, and Arnie Cunningham, equipped with hot rum punches, Uncle Steve's avowed specialty of the season, were gathering around the television with Uncle Steve and Aunt Vicky to watch Alastair Sim in A Christmas Carol, a 40-mile stretch of the Pennsylvania Turnpike had been closed by drifting snow. By midnight, almost all of it would be closed. By 9:30, when Christine's headlights suddenly came on in Will Darnell's deserted garage, cutting a bright arc through the interior blackness, Libertyville had totally shut down, except for the occasional cruising plows. In the silent garage, Christine's engine gunned and fell off, gunned and fell off. In the empty front seat, the gear shift lever dropped down into drive. Christine began to move. The electric eye gadget, clipped to the driver's sun visor, hummed briefly. Its low sound was lost in the howl of the wind. But the door heard. It rattled upward obediently on its tracks. Snow blew in and swirled gustily. Christine passed outside, wraith-like in the snow. She turned right and moved down the street, her tires cutting through the deep snow cleanly and firmly, with no spin, skid, or hesitation. A turn blinker came on, one amber winking eye in the snow. She turned left toward JFK Drive. Don Vandenberg sat behind the desk inside the office of his father's gas station. Both his feet and his pecker were up. He was reading one of his father's fuck books, a deeply incisive and thought-provoking tome titled Swap Around Pammy. Pammy had gotten it from just about everyone but the milkman and the dog, and the milkman was coming up the drive, and the dog was lying at her feet when the bell dinged, signaling a customer. Don looked up impatiently. He had called his father at 6, 4 hours ago, and asked him if he shouldn't close the station down. There wouldn't be enough business tonight to pay for the electricity it took to light up the sign. His father, sitting home warm and toasty and safely shit-faced, had told him to keep it open until midnight. If there ever was a Scrooge, Don had thought resentfully as he slammed the phone back down, his old man was it. The simple fact was, he didn't like being alone at night anymore. Once, and not so long ago at that, he would have had plenty of company. Buddy would have been here. And Buddy was a magnet, drawing the others with his booze, his occasional gram of coke, but most of all with the simple force of his personality. But now they were gone. All gone. Except, sometimes it seemed to Don that they weren't. Sometimes it seemed to him, when he was alone as he was tonight, that he might look up and see them sitting there. Richie Trelawney on one side, Moochie Welch on the other, and Buddy between them, with a bottle of Texas Driver in his hand and a joint cocked behind his ear. Horribly white, all three of them, like vampires, their eyes as glazed as the eyes of dead fish. And Buddy would hold out the bottle and whisper, "Get yourself a drink, asshole. Pretty soon you'll be dead like us." These fantasies were sometimes real enough to leave him with his mouth dry and his hands shaking. And the reason why wasn't lost on Don. They never should have trashed old Cuntface's car that night. Every single one of the guys in on that little prank had died horrible deaths. All of them. That was, except for him and Sandy Galton. And Sandy had gotten in that old broken-down Mustang of his and taken off somewhere. On these long night shifts, Don often thought he would like to do the same. Outside, the customer beeped his horn. Don slammed the book down on the desk next to the greasy credit card machine and struggled into his parka, peering out at the car and wondering who would be crazy enough to be out in a shitstorm like this one. In the blowing snow, it was impossible to tell anything about either the car or the customer. He could make out nothing for sure but the headlights and the shape of the body, which was too long for a new car. Someday, he thought, drawing on his gloves and bidding a reluctant farewell to his hard-on, his father would put in self-service pumps and all this shit would end. If people were crazy enough to be out on a night like this, they should have to pump their own gas. The door almost ripped itself out of his hand. He held onto it so it wouldn't slam back into the cinder block side of the building and maybe shatter the glass. He almost went down on his ass for his pains. In spite of the steady hooting of the wind, which he had been trying not to hear, he had totally misjudged the force of the storm. The very depth of the snow, better than 8 inches, helped to keep him on his feet. That fucking car must be on snowshoes, he thought resentfully. Guy gives me a credit card, I'm going to fuse his spine. He waded through the snow, approaching the first set of islands. The fuckstick had parked at the far set, naturally. Don tried to glance up once, but the wind threw snow into his face in a stinging sheet, and he lowered his head quickly, letting the top of the parka's hood take the brunt of it. He crossed in front of the car, bathed for a moment in the bright but heatless glow of its dual headlights. He struggled and floundered around to the driver's side. The pump island's fluorescence made the car into a garish white over purple burgundy shade. His cheeks were already numb. If this guy wants a dollar's worth and asks me to check the oil, I'm telling him to cram it, he thought, and raised his head into the sting of the snow as the window went down. Can I he began, and the sound of help you became a high, hissing, strengthless scream. Leaning out of the window, less than 6 inches from his own face, was a rotting corpse. Its eyes were wide, empty sockets. Its mummified lips were drawn back from a few yellowed, leaning teeth. One hand lay whitely on the steering wheel. The other, clicking hurriedly, reached out to touch him. Don floundered backward, his heart a runaway engine in his chest, his terror a monstrous hot rock in his throat. That dead thing beckoned him, grinning, and the car's engine suddenly screamed, piling up revs. "Fill it up," the corpse whispered, and in spite of his shock and horror, Don saw it was wearing the tattered and moss-slimed remains of an army uniform. "Fill it up, you shitter." Skull teeth grinned in the fluorescent light. Far back in that mouth, a bit of gold twinkled. "Catch yourself a drink, asshole," another voice whispered hoarsely, and Buddy Repperton leaned forward in the back seat, extending a bottle of Texas Driver toward Don. Worms spilled and squirmed through his grin. Beetles crawled in what remained of his hair. "I think you must need one." Don shrieked, the sound bulleting up and out of him. He whirled away, running through the snow in great, leaping, cartoon steps. He shrieked again as the car's engine screamed V8 power. He looked back over his shoulder and saw that it was Christine standing by the pumps. Arnie's Christine, now moving, churning snow up behind her rear tires. And the things he had seen were gone. That was even worse somehow. The things were gone. The car was moving on its own. He had turned toward the street, and now he climbed up over the snowbank thrown up by the passing plows and down the other side. Here the wind had swept the pavement clear of everything except an occasional blister of ice. Don skidded on one of these. His feet went out from under him. He landed on his back with a thump. A moment later, the street was flooded with white light. Don rolled over and looked up, eyes straining wildly in their sockets, in time to see the huge white circles of Christine's headlights as she slammed through the snowbank and bore down on him like a locomotive. Like Gaul, all of Libertyville Heights was divided into three parts. The semicircle closest to town, on the low shoal of hills that had been known as Liberty Lookout until the mid-19th century, a bicentennial plaque on the corner of Rogers and Tacklin Streets so reminded, was the town's only real four-section. It was an unhappy warren of apartments and wooden frame buildings. Rope clotheslines spanned scruffy backyards, which were, in more temperate seasons, littered with kids and Fisher-Price toys. In too many cases, both kids and toys had been badly battered. This neighborhood, once middle class, had been growing tackier ever since the war jobs had dried up in 1945. The decline moved slowly at first, then began to gain speed in the 60s and early 70s. Now the worst yet had come, although nobody would come right out and say it, at least not in public, where he or she could be quoted. Now the blacks were moving in. It was said in private, in the better parts of town, over barbecues and drinks. The blacks, God help us, the blacks are discovering Libertyville. The area had even gained its own name. Not Liberty Lookout, but the Low Heights. It was a name many found chillingly ghetto-ish. The editor of the Keystone had been quietly informed by several of his biggest advertisers that to use that phrase in print, thus legitimizing it, would make them very unhappy. The editor, whose mother had raised no fools, never did so. Heights Avenue split off from Basin Drive in Libertyville proper and then began to rise. It cut cleanly through the middle of the Low Heights and then left them behind. The road then climbed through a green belt and into a residential area. This section of town was known simply as the Heights. All this might seem confusing to you, Heights this and Heights that, but Libertyville residents knew what they were talking about. When you said the Low Heights, you meant poverty, genteel or otherwise. When you left off the adjective low, you meant poverty's direct opposite. Here were fine old homes, most of them set tastefully back from the road, some of the finest behind thick yew hedges. Libertyville's movers and shakers lived here. The newspaper publisher, four doctors, the rich and dotty granddaughter of the man who had invented the rapid-fire ejection system for automatic pistols. Most of the rest were lawyers. Beyond this area of respectable small-town wealth, Heights Avenue passed through a wooded area that was really too thick to be called a greenbelt. The woods lined both sides of the road for more than 3 miles. At the highest point of the Heights, Stanson Road branched off to the left, dead-ending at the embankment overlooking the town and the Libertyville drive-in. On the other side of this low mountain, but also known as the Heights, was a fairly old, middle-class neighborhood, where houses 40 and 50 years old were slowly mellowing. As this area began to thin out in the countryside, Heights Avenue became County Road Number 2. At 10:30 on that Christmas Eve, a 1958 two-tone Plymouth moved up Heights Avenue, its lights cutting through the snow-choked, raving dark. Long-time natives of the Heights would have said that nothing, except maybe a four-wheel drive, could have gotten up Heights Avenue that night. But Christine moved along at a steady 30 miles an hour, headlights probing, wipers moving rhythmically back and forth, totally empty within. Its fresh tracks were alone, and in places they were almost a foot deep. The steady wind filled them in quickly. Now and again her front bumper and hood would explode through the ridged back of a snowdrift, nosing the powder aside easily. Christine passed the Stanson Road turnoff and the embankment where Arnie and Lee had once trysted. She reached the top of Liberty Heights and headed down the far side, at first through black woods cut only by the white ribbon that marked the road, then past the suburban houses with their cozy living room lights, and in some cases their cheery trim of Christmas lights. In one of these houses, a young man who had just finished playing Santa and who was having a drink with his wife to celebrate happened to glance out and see headlights passing by. He pointed it out to her. "If that guy came over the Heights tonight," this young man said with a grin, "he must have had the devil riding shotgun." "Never mind that," she said. "Now that the kids are taken care of, what do I get from Santa?" He grinned. "We'll think of something." Farther down the road, almost at the point where the Heights ceased being the Heights, Will Darnell sat in the living room of the simple two-story frame house he had owned for 30 years. He was wearing a bald and fading blue terry cloth robe over his pajama bottoms, his huge sack of stomach pushing out like a swollen moon. He was watching the final conversion of Ebenezer Scrooge to the side of goodness and generosity, but not really seeing it. His mind was once more sifting through the pieces of a puzzle that grew steadily more fascinating. Arnie, Welch, Repperton, Christine. Will had aged a decade in the week or so since the bust. He had told that cop Mercer that he would be back doing business at the same old stand in 2 weeks, but in his heart, he wondered. It seemed that lately his throat was always slimy from the taste of that goddamn aspirator. Arnie, Welch, Refferton, Christine. Boy! Scrooge hailed down from his window, a caricature of the Christmas spirit in his nightgown and cap. Is the prize turkey still in the butcher's window? What? The boy asked. The one as big as I am? Yes, yes, Scrooge answered, giggling wildly. It was as if the three spirits had, instead of saving him, driven him mad. The one as big as you are. Arnie, Welch, Repperton, LeBay? Sometimes he thought it was not the bust that had tired him out and made him feel so constantly beaten and afraid, that it was not even the fact that they had busted his pet accountant, or that the federal tax people were in on it and were obviously loaded for bear this time. The tax people weren't the reason that he had begun scanning the street before going out mornings. The state attorney general's office didn't have anything to do with the sudden glances he had begun throwing back over his shoulder when he was driving home nights from the garage. He had gone over what he had seen that night, or what he thought he had seen, again and again, trying to convince himself that it was absolutely not real, or that it absolutely was. For the first time in years, he found himself doubting his own senses. And as the event receded into the past, it became easier to believe he had fallen asleep and dreamed the whole thing. He hadn't seen Arnie since the bust, or tried to call him on the telephone. At first he had thought to use his knowledge about Christine as a lever to keep Arnie's mouth shut if the kid weakened and took a notion to talk. God knew the kid could go a long way toward sending him to jail if he cooperated with the cops. It wasn't until after the police had landed everywhere that Will realized how much the kid knew. And he had had a few panicky moments of self-appraisal, something else that was upsetting because it was so foreign to his nature. Had all of them known that much? Repperton and all the hoodie Repperton clones stretching back over the years? Could he actually have been so stupid? No, he decided. It was only Cunningham, because Cunningham was different. He seemed to understand things almost intuitively. He wasn't all brag and booze and bullshit. In a queer way, Will felt almost fatherly toward the boy. Not that he would have hesitated to cut the kid loose if it started to look as if he was going to rock the boat. And not that I'd hesitate now, he assured himself. On the TV, a scratchy, black-and-white Scrooge was with the Cratchits. The film was almost over. The whole bunch of them looked like loonies, and that was the truth. But Scrooge was definitely the worst. The look of mad joy in his eye was not so different from the look in the eye of a man Will had known 20 years before, a fellow named Everett Dingle, who had gone home from the garage one afternoon and murdered his entire family. Will lit a cigar. Anything to take the taste of the aspirator out of his mouth, that rotten taste. Lately it seemed harder than ever to catch his breath. Damned cigars didn't help, but he was too old to change now. The kid hadn't talked. At least, not yet, he hadn't. The attorney Henry Buck, Will's lawyer, had told him. Henry, who was 63 and a grandfather, would have denied Christ 3 times if they had promised him a dismissal or even a suspended sentence in return. Old Henry Buck was sicking up everything he knew, which fortunately wasn't a great deal. He knew about the fireworks and cigarettes, but that had only been 2 rings of what had been at one time a 6- or 7-ring circus, encompassing booze, hot cars, discount firearms, including a few machine guns sold to gun nuts and homicidal hunters who wanted to see if one would really tear up a deer like I heard, and stolen antiques from New England. And in the last couple of years, cocaine. That had been a mistake, he knew it now. Those Colombians down in Miami were as crazy as shithouse rats. Come to think of it, they were shithouse rats. Thank Christ they hadn't caught the kid holding a pound of coke. Well, they were going to hurt him this time. How much or how little depended a great deal on that weird 17-year-old kid, and maybe on his weird car. Things were as delicately balanced as a house of cards, and Will hesitated to do or say anything for fear he would change things for the worse. And there was always the possibility that Cunningham would laugh in his face and call him crazy. Will got up, cigar clamped in his jaws, and shut off his television set. He should go to bed, but maybe he would have a brandy first. He was always tired now, but sleep came hard. He turned toward the kitchen, and that was when the horn began to honk outside. the sound came over the howl of the wind in short, imperative blasts. Will stopped cold in the kitchen doorway and belted his robe closed across his big stomach. His face was sharp and racked and alive, suddenly the face of a much younger man. He stood there a moment longer. Three more short, sharp honks. He turned back, taking the cigar from his mouth, and walked slowly across the living room. An almost dreamlike sense of déjà vu washed over him like warm water. Mixed with it was a feeling of fatalism. He knew it was Christine out there, even before he brushed the curtain back and looked out. She had come for him, as he supposed he knew she might. The car stood at the head of his turnaround driveway, little more than a ghost in the membranes of blowing snow. Its brights shone out in widening cones that at last disappeared into the storm. For a moment it seemed to Will that someone was behind the wheel, but he blinked again and saw that the car was empty as it had been when it returned to the garage that night. Wonk, 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 almost as if it were talking. Will's heart thudded heavily in his chest. He turned abruptly to the phone. The time had come to call Cunningham after all, call him and tell him to bring his pet demon to heel. He was halfway there when he heard the car's engine scream. The sound was like the shriek of a woman who sensed treachery. A moment later, there was a heavy crunch. Will went back to the window and was in time to see the car backing away from the high snowbank that fronted the end of his driveway. Its hood, sprayed with clods of snow, had crimped slightly. The engine revved again. The rear wheels spun in the powdery snow and then caught hold. The car leaped across the snowy road and struck the snowbank again. More snow exploded up and raftered away on the wind like cigar smoke blown in front of a fan. Never do it, Will thought. And even if you get into the driveway, what then? You think I'm going to come out and play? Wheezing more sharply than ever, he went back to the phone, looked up Cunningham's home number, and started to dial it. His fingers jittered, he misdialed, swore, hit the cutoff buttons, started again. Outside, Christine's engine revved. A moment later, there was a crunch as she hit the embankment for the third time. The wind wailed, and snow struck the big picture window like dry sand. Will licked his lips and tried to breathe slowly, but his throat was closing up. He could feel it. The phone began to ring on the other end. Three times. Four. Christine's engine screamed, then the heavy thud as she hit the snowbank the passing plows had piled up at both ends of Will's semicircular driveway. Six rings. Seven. Nobody home. Shit on it, Will whispered, and slammed the phone back down. His face was pale. His nostrils flared wide like the nostrils of an animal scenting fire upwind. His cigar had gone out. He threw it on the carpet and groped in his bathrobe pocket as he hurried back to the window. His hand found the comforting shape of his aspirator, and his fingers curled around its pistol grip. Headlights shone momentarily in his face, nearly blinding him, and Will raised his free hand to shield his eyes. Christine hit the snowbank again. Little by little, she was bludgeoning her way through to the driveway. He watched her back up across the road and wished savagely for a plow to come along now and hit the damned thing broadside. No plow came. Christine came again instead, engine howling, lights glaring across his snow-covered lawn. She struck the snowbank, pushing mounds of snow violently to either side. The front end canted up, and for a moment Will thought she was going to come right over what was left of the frozen, hard-packed embankment. Then the rear wheels lost traction and spun frantically. She backed up. Will's throat felt as if its bore was down to a pinhole. His lungs strained for air. He took the aspirator out and used it. The police. He ought to call the police. They would come. Cunningham's .58 couldn't get him. He was safe in his house. Christine came again, accelerating across the road. And this time she hit the bank and came over it easily, front end at first tilting up, splashing the front of his house with light, then crashing back down. She was in the driveway. Yes, all right, but she could come no further. Christine never slowed. Still accelerating, she crossed the semicircular driveway on a tangent, plowed through the shallower, looser snow of the side yard, and roared directly at the picture window where Will Darnell stood, looking out. He staggered backward, gasping hard, and tripped over his own easy chair. Christine hit the house. The picture window exploded, letting in the shrieking wind. Glass flew in deadly arrows, each of them reflecting Christine's headlamps. Snow blew in and danced over the rug in erratic corkscrews. The headlights momentarily illuminated the room with the unnatural glare of a television studio, and then she withdrew, her front bumper dragging, her hood popped up, her grill smashed into a chrome-dripping grin full of fangs. Will was on his hands and knees, gagging harshly for breath, his chest heaving. He was vaguely aware that, had he not tripped over his chair and fallen down, he probably would have been cut to ribbons by flying glass. His robe had come undone and flapped behind him as he got to his feet. The wind streaming in the window picked up the TV guide from the little table by his chair, and the magazine flew across the room to the foot of the stairs, pages riffling. Will got the telephone in both hands and dialed a zero. Christine reversed along her own tracks through the snow. She went all the way back to the flattened snowbank at the entrance to the driveway. Then she came forward, accelerating rapidly. And as she came, the hood immediately began to uncrimp, the grill to regenerate itself. She slammed into the side of the house below the picture window again. More glass flew, wood splintered and groaned and creaked. The big window's low ledge cracked in two, and for a moment, Christine's windshield, now cracked and milky, seemed to peer in like a giant alien eye. "Police," Will said to the operator. His voice was hardly there. It was all wheeze and whistle. His bathrobe flapped in the cold blizzard wind coming in through the shattered window. He saw that the wall below the window was nearly shattered. Broken chunks of lathing protruded like fractured bones. It couldn't get in, could it? Could it?
"I'm sorry, sir. You'll have to speak up," the operator said. "We seem to have a very bad connection."
"Police," Will said, but this time it wasn't even a whisper, only a hiss of air. Dear God, he was strangling. He was choking. His chest was a locked bank vault. Where was his aspirator?
"Sir?"
the operator asked doubtfully. There it was on the floor. Will dropped the telephone and scrabbled for it. Christine came again, roaring across the lawn and striking the side of the house. This time, the entire wall gave way in a shrapnel burst of glass and lathing, and incredibly, nightmarishly, Christine's smashed and dented hood was in his living room. She was in. He could smell exhaust and hot engine. Christine's underworks caught on something, and she reversed back out of the ragged hole with a screech of pulling boards, her front end a gored ruin, dusted with snow and plaster. But she would come again in a few seconds, and this time she might, just might. Will grabbed his respirator and ran blindly for the stairs. He was only halfway up when the revving whine of her engine came again, and he turned to watch, leaning on the railing more than grasping it. The stairwell's height lent a certain nightmare perspective. He watched Christine come across the snow-covered lawn, saw her hood fly up so that now her front end resembled the mouth of a huge red-and-white alligator. Then it snapped off altogether as she struck the house again, this time doing better than 40. She ripped away the last of the window frame and sprayed more splintered boards across his living room. Her headlights bounced upward, glaring, and then she was in. She was in his house, leaving a huge torn hole in the wall behind her with an electrical cable hanging out under the rug like a black severed artery. Little clouds of blown-in fiberglass insulation danced on the cold wind like milkweed puffs. Will screamed and couldn't hear himself over the blatting roar of her engine. The Sears muzzler Arnie had put on her, one of the few things he really put on her, Will thought crazily, had hung up on the sill of the house, along with most of the tailpipe. The fury roared across the living room, knocking Will's lazy boy armchair onto its side, where it lay like a dead pony. The floor under Christine creaked uneasily, and a part of Will's mind screamed, "Yes, break, break, spill the goddamn thing into the cellar. Let's see it climb out of there." And this image was replaced with the image of a tiger in a pit that had been dug and then camouflaged by wily natives. But the floor held, at least for the time being it held. Christine roared across the living room at him. Behind, she left a zigzag pattern of snowy tire prints on the rug. She slammed into the stairs. Will was thrown back against the wall. His aspirator fell out of his hand and tumbled end over end all the way to the bottom. Christine reversed across the room, floorboards groaning underneath. Her rear end struck the Sony TV, and the picture tube imploded. She roared forward again and struck the side of the stairs again, shattering lath and gouging out plaster. Will could feel the entire structure grow wobbly under him. There was an awful sensation of lean. For a moment, Christine was directly beneath him. He could look down into the oily gut of her engine compartment, could feel the heat of her V8 mill. She reversed again, and Will scrambled up the stairs, heaving for air, clawing at the fat sausage of his throat, eyes bulging. He reached the top, an instant before Christine hit the wall again, turning the center of the stairs into a jumbled wreck. A long splinter of wood fell into her engine. The fan chewed it up and spat out coarse-grained sawdust and smaller splinters. The entire house smelled of gas and exhaust. Will's ears rang with the heavy thunder of that merciless engine. She backed up again. Now her tires had chewed ragged trenches in the carpet. Down the hall, Will thought. Attic. Attic will be safe. Yes, the attic. Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, my God. The final pain came with sharp, spiking suddenness. It was as if his heart had been punctured with an icicle. His left arm locked with pain. Still, there was no breath. His chest heaved uselessly. He staggered backward. One foot danced out over nothingness. And then he fell back down the stairs in two great, bone-snapping barrel rolls, legs flying over his head, arms waving, blue bathrobe sailing and flapping. He landed in a heap at the bottom, and Christine pounced upon him, struck him, reversed, struck him again, snapped off the heavy newel post at the foot of the stairs like a twig, reversed, struck him again. From beneath the floor came the increasing mutter of supports splintering and bowing. Christine paused in the middle of the room for a moment, as if listening. Two of her tires were flat. A third had come half off the wheel. The left side of the car was punched inward, scraped clean of paint in great bald patches. Suddenly, her gear shift dropped into reverse. Her engine screamed, and she rocketed back across the room and out of the ragged hole in the side of Will Darnell's house, her rear end dropping down several inches and into the snow. The tires spun, found some purchase, and pulled her out. She backed limpingly toward the road, her engine chopping and missing now, blue smoke hazing the air around her, oil dripping and spraying. At the road, she turned back toward Libertyville. The gearshift lever dropped into drive, but at first the damaged transmission wouldn't catch. When it did, she rolled slowly away from the house. Behind her, from Will's house, a broad bar of light shone out onto the churned-up snow, in a shape that was not at all like the neat rectangle of light thrown by a window. The shape of the light on the snow was senseless and strange. She moved slowly, lurching from side to side on her flats, like a very old drunk making her way up an alley. Snow fell thickly, driven into slanting lines by the wind. One of her headlights, shattered in her last destructive trampling charge, flickered and came on. One of the tires began to reinflate, then the other. The clouds of stinking oil smoke began to diminish. The engine's chopping, uncertain note smoothed out. The missing hood began to reappear, from the windshield end down, looking weirdly like a scarf or cardigan being knitted by invisible needles. The raw metal drew itself out of nothing, gleamed steel gray, and then darkened to red, as if filling with blood. The cracks in the windshield began to run in reverse, leaving unflawed smoothness behind themselves. The other headlights came on, one after the other. Now she moved with swift surety through the stormy night, behind the cutting edge of her confident brights. Her odometer spun smoothly backward. 45 minutes later, she sat in the darkness of the late Will Darnell's do-it-yourself garage in stall 20. The wind howled and moaned in the ranks of the wrecks out back, rusting hulks that perhaps held their own ghosts and their own baleful memories, as powdery snow skirled across the ripped and tattered seats, their balding floor carpets. Her engine ticked slowly, cooling. Part 3. Christine, Teenage Death Songs. 43. Lee comes to visit. James Dean in that Mercury 49, Junior Johnson Bonner through the woods of Caroline, even Burt Reynolds in that black Trans Am, all going to meet down at the Cadillac Ranch. Bruce Springsteen. About 15 minutes before Lee was due, I got my crutches under me and worked my way to the chair closest to the door so she'd be sure to hear me when I hollered for her to come in. Then I picked up my copy of Esquire again and turned back to an article titled The Next Vietnam, which was part of a school assignment. I still had no success reading it. I was nervous and scared, and part of it, a lot of it, I guess, was simple eagerness. I wanted to see her again. The house was empty. Not too long after Lee called that stormy Christmas Eve afternoon, I got my dad aside and asked him if he could maybe take Mom and Elaine someplace the afternoon of the 26th. Why not? He agreed amiably enough. Thanks, Dad. Sure, but you owe me one, Dennis. Dad! He winked solemnly. I'll scratch your back if you'll scratch mine. Nice guy, I said. A real prince, he agreed. My dad, who was no slouch, asked me if it had to do with Arnie. She's his girl, isn't she? Well, I said, not sure just what the situation was and uncomfortable for reasons of my own. She has been. I don't know about now. Problems? I didn't do such a hot job being his eyes, did I? It's hard to see you from a hospital bed, Dennis. I'll make sure your mother and Ellie are out Tuesday afternoon. Just be careful, okay? Since then, I've pondered exactly what he might have meant by that. He surely couldn't have been worried about me trying to jump Lee's bones with one upper leg still in plaster and a half cast on my back. I think maybe he was just afraid that something had gotten terribly out of whack with my old childhood friend suddenly a stranger, and a stranger who was out on bail at that. I sure thought something was out of whack, and it scared the piss out of me. The Keystone doesn't publish on Christmas, but all three Pittsburgh Network TV affiliates and both the independent channels had the story of what had happened to Will Darnell, along with bizarre and frightening pictures of his house. The side facing the road had been demolished. It was the only word which fit. That side of the house looked as if some mad Nazi had driven a Panzer tank through it. The story had been headlined this morning, Foul Play Suspected in Bizarre Death of Suspected Crime Figure. That was bad enough, even without another picture of Will Darnell's house with that big hole punched in the side. But you had to check page 3 to get the rest of it. The other item was smaller because Will Darnell had been a suspected crime figure, and Don Vandenberg had only been a dipshit dropout gas jockey. Service station attendant killed in Christmas Eve hit and run, this headline read. A single column followed. The story ended with the Libertyville chief of police theorizing that the driver had probably been drunk or stoned. Neither he nor the Keystone made any attempt to connect the deaths, which had been separated by almost 10 miles on the night of a screaming blizzard which had stopped all traffic in Ohio and western Pennsylvania. But I could make connections. I didn't want to, but I couldn't help it. And hadn't my father been looking at me strangely several times during the morning? Yes. Once or twice it had seemed he would say something. I had no idea what I would say if he did. Will Darnell's death, bizarre as it had been, was nowhere nearly as bizarre as my suspicions. Then he had closed his mouth without speaking. That, to be upfront about it, was something of a relief. The doorbell chimed at 2 past 2. Come on in, I yelled, getting up on my crutches again anyway. The door opened and Lee poked her head in. Dennis? Yeah, come on in. She did, looking very pretty in a bright red ski parka and dark blue pants. She pushed the parka's fur-edged hood back. Sit down, she said, unzipping her parka. Go on, right now. That's an order. You look like a big dumb stork on those things. Keep it up, I said, sitting down again with an ungainly plop. When you're cast in plaster, it's never like in the movies. You never sit down like Cary Grant getting ready to have cocktails at the Ritz with Ingrid Bergman. It all happens at once, and if the cushion you land on doesn't give out a big loud raspberry, as if your sudden descent had scared you into cutting the cheese, you count yourself ahead of the game. This time I got lucky. I'm such a sucker for flattery that I make myself sick. How are you, Dennis? Mending, I said. How about you? I've been better, she said in a low voice and bit at her lower lip. This can sometimes be a seductive gesture on a girl's part, but it wasn't this time. Hang up your coat and sit down yourself. Okay. Her eyes touched mine, and looking at them was a little much. I looked someplace else, thinking about Arnie. She hung her coat up and came back into the living room slowly. Your folks? I got my father to take everyone out, I said. I thought maybe, I shrugged, we ought to talk just between ourselves. She stood by the sofa, looking at me across the room. I was struck again by the simplicity of her good looks, her lovely girl's figure outlined in dark blue pants and a sweater of a lighter powdery blue, an outfit that made me think about skiing. Her hair was tied in a loose pigtail and lay over her left shoulder. Her eyes were the color of her sweater, maybe a little darker. A corn-fed American beauty, you would have said, except for the high cheekbones, which seemed a little arrogant, bespeaking some older, more exotic heritage. Maybe some 15 or 20 generations back there was a Viking in the woodpile. Or maybe that isn't what I was thinking at all. She saw me looking at her too long and blushed. I looked away. Dennis, are you worried about him? Worried? Scared might be a better word. What do you know about that car? What has he told you? Not much, I said. Look, would you like something to drink? There's some stuff in the fridge. I felt for my crutches. Sit still, she said. I would like something, but I'll get it. What about you? I'll take a ginger ale if there's one left. She went into the kitchen, and I watched her shadow on the wall, moving lightly, like a dancer. There was a momentary added weight in my stomach, almost like a sickness. There's a name for that sort of sickness. I think it's called falling in love with your best friend's girl. You've got an automatic ice maker, her voice floated back. We've got one, too. I love it. Sometimes it goes crazy and sprays ice cubes all over the floor, I said. It's like Jimmy Cagney in White Heat. Take that, you dirty rats. It drives my mother crazy. I was babbling. She laughed. Ice cubes clinked in glasses. Shortly, she came back with 2 glasses of ice and 2 cans of Canada Dry. Thanks, I said, taking mine. No, thank you, she said. And now her blue eyes were dark and sober. Thanks for being around. If I had to deal with this alone, I think I don't know. Come on, I said. It's not that bad. Isn't it? Do you know about Darnell? I nodded. And that other one, Don Vandenberg? So she had made the connection, too. I nodded again. I saw it. Lee, what is it about Christine that bothers you? For a long time, I didn't know if she was going to answer. If she would be able to answer. I could see her struggling with it, looking down at her glass held in both hands. At last, in a very low voice, she said, I think she tried to kill me. I don't know what I had expected, but it wasn't that. What do you mean? She talked, first hesitantly, then more rapidly, until it was pouring out of her. It is a story you have already heard, so I won't repeat it here. Suffice it to say that I've tried to tell it pretty much as she told it to me. She hadn't been kidding about being scared. It was in the pallor of her face, the little hitches and gulps of her voice, the way her hands constantly caressed her upper arms as if she was too cold in spite of the sweater. And the more she talked, the more scared I got. She finished by telling me how, as consciousness dwindled, the dashboard lights had seemed to turn into watching eyes. She laughed nervously at this last, as if trying to take the curse off an obvious absurdity, but I didn't laugh back. I was remembering George LeBay's dry voice as we sat in cheap patio chairs in front of the Rainbow Motel, his voice telling me the story of Roland, Veronica, and Rita. I was remembering those things, and my mind was making unspeakable connections. Lights were going on. I didn't like what they were revealing. My heart started to thud heavily in my chest, and I couldn't have joined her laughter if my life had depended on it. She told me about the ultimatum she had given him, her or the car. She told me about Arnie's furious reaction. That had been the last time she went out with him. Then he got arrested, she said, and I started to think about what had happened to Buddy Repperton and those other boys, and Moochie Welch, and now Vandenberg and Darnell. Yes, but that's not all. She drank from her glass of ginger ale and then poured in more. The edge of the can chattered briefly against the rim of the glass. Christmas Eve, when I called you, my mom and dad went out for drinks at my dad's boss's house, and I started to get nervous. I was thinking about... Oh, I don't know what I was thinking about. I think you do. She put a hand to her forehead and rubbed it, as if she was getting a headache. I suppose I do. I was thinking about that car being out. Her being out and getting them. But if she was out on Christmas Eve, I guess she had plenty to keep her busy without bothering my parents. She slammed her glass down, making me jump. And why do I keep talking about that car as if it was a person? She cried out. Tears had begun to spill down her cheeks. Why do I keep doing that? On that night, I saw all too clearly what comforting her could lead to. Arnie was between us. And part of myself was, too. I had known him for a long time, a long good time. But that was then. This was now. I got my crutches under me, thumped my way across to the couch, and plopped down beside her. The cushion sighed. It wasn't a raspberry, but it was close. My mother keeps a box of Kleenex in the drawer of the little end table. I pulled one out, looked at her.
and pulled out a whole handful. I gave them to her, and she thanked me. Then, not liking myself much, I put an arm around her and held her. She stiffened for a moment, and then let me draw her against my shoulder. She was trembling. We just sat that way, both of us afraid of even the slightest movement, I think. Afraid we might explode or something. Across the room, the clock ticked importantly on the mantelpiece. Bright winter light fell through the bow windows that gave a three-way view of the street. The storm had blown itself out by noon on Christmas Day, and now the hard and cloudless blue sky seemed to deny that there even was such a thing as snow. But the dune-like drifts rolling across lawns all up and down the street like the backs of great buried beasts confirmed it. "The smell," I said at last. "How sure are you about that?" "It was there," she said, drawing away from me and sitting up straight. I collected my arm again, with a mixed sensation of disappointment and relief. "It really was there, a rotten, horrible smell." She looked at me. "Why, have you smelled it too?" I shook my head. "I never had, not really." "What do you know about that car, then?" she asked. "You know something. I can see it on your face." It was my turn to think long and hard. And oddly, what came into my mind was an image of nuclear fission from some science textbook. A cartoon. You don't expect to see cartoons in science books, but as someone once said to me, there are many devious twists and turns along the path of public education. In point of fact, that someone had been Arnie himself. The cartoon showed two hot rod atoms speeding toward each other and then slamming together. Presto! Instead of a lot of wreckage and atom ambulances to take away the dead and wounded neutrons, critical mass, chain reaction, and one hell of a big bang. Then I decided the memory of that cartoon really wasn't odd at all. Lee had certain information I hadn't had before. The reverse was also true. In both cases, a lot of it was guesswork, a lot of it was subjective feeling and circumstance. But enough of it was hard information to be really scary. I wondered briefly what the police would do if they knew what we did. I could guess nothing. Could you bring a ghost to trial? Or a car? "Dennis?" "I'm thinking," I said. "Can't you smell the wood burning?" "What do you know?" she asked again. "Collision, critical mass, chain reaction, kaboom." The thing was, I was thinking, if we put our information together, we would have to do something or tell someone, take some action. I remembered of my dream. The car sitting there in LeBay's garage, the motor revving up and then falling off. Revving up again, the headlights coming on, the shriek of tires. I took her hands in both of mine. "Okay," I said, "listen. Arnie, he bought Christine from a guy who is dead now, a guy named Roland D. LeBay. We saw her on his lawn one day when we were coming home from work, and..." "You're doing it, too," she said softly. "What?" "Calling it she." I nodded, not letting go of her hands. "Yeah, I know. It's hard to stop. The thing is, Arnie wanted her, or it, or whatever that car is, from the first time he laid eyes on her. And I think now, I didn't then, but I do now, that LeBay wanted Arnie to have her just as badly, that he would have given her to him if it had come to that. It's like Arnie saw Christine and knew, and then LeBay saw Arnie and knew the same thing." Lee pulled her hands free of mine and began to rub her elbows restlessly again. "Arnie said he paid..." "He paid all right, and he's still paying. That is, if Arnie's left at all." "I don't understand what you mean." "I'll show you," I said, "in a few minutes. First, let me give you the background." "All right." LeBay had a wife and daughter. This was back in the 50s. His daughter died beside the road. She choked to death on a hamburger. Lee's face grew white, then whiter. For a moment, she seemed as milky and translucent as clouded glass. "Lee," I said sharply, "are you all right?" "Yes," she said with a chilling placidity. Her color didn't improve. Her mouth moved in a horrid grimace that was perhaps intended to be a reassuring smile. "I'm fine." She stood up. "Where's the bathroom, please?" "There's one at the end of the hall," I said. "Lee, you look awful." "I'm going to vomit," she said, in that same placid voice, and walked away. She moved jerkily now, like a puppet, all the dancer's grace I had seen in her shadow, now gone. She walked out of the room slowly. But when she was out of sight, the rhythm of her stride picked up. I heard the bathroom door thrown open, and then the sounds. I leaned back against the sofa and put my hands over my eyes. When she came back, she was still pale, but had regained a touch of her color. She had washed her face, and there were still a few drops of water on her cheeks. "I'm sorry," I said. "It's all right. It just startled me." She smiled wanly. "I guess that's an understatement." She caught my eyes with hers. "Just tell me one thing, Dennis. What you said, is it true, really true?" "Yeah," I said, "it's true, and there's more. But do you really want to hear any more?" "No," she said, "but tell me anyway." "We could drop it," I said, not really believing it. Her grave, distressed eyes held mine. "It might be safer if we didn't," she said. His wife committed suicide shortly after their daughter died. The car was involved.
How?
Lee. How? So I told her, not just about the little girl and her mother, but about Lee Bay himself, as his brother George had told me, his bottomless reservoir of anger, the kids who had made fun of his clothes and his bowl haircut, his escape into the army, where everyone's clothes and haircuts were the same, the motor pool, the constant railing at the shitters, particularly those shitters who brought him their big expensive cars to be fixed at government expense, the Second World War, the brother, Drew, killed in France, the old Chevrolet, the old Hudson Hornet, and through it all, a steady and unchanging backbeat, the anger.
"That word," Lee murmured.
"What word?"
"Shitters."
She had to force herself to say it, her nose wrinkling in rueful and almost unconscious distaste. "He uses it. Arnie."
"I know."
We looked at each other, and her hands found mine again.
"You're cold," I said.
"Another bright remark from that font of wisdom, Dennis Gilder. I got a million of them."
"Yes. I feel like I'll never be warm again."
I wanted to put my arms around her, and didn't. I was afraid to. Arnie was still too much mixed up in things. The most awful thing, and it was awful, was how it seemed more and more that he was dead. Dead or under some weird enchantment.
"Did his brother say anything else?"
"Nothing that seems to fit." But a memory rose like a bubble in still water and popped. "He was obsessed and he was angry, but he was not a monster," George LeBay had told me. "At least, I don't think he was." It had seemed that, lost in the past as he had been about to say something more, and then had realized where he was and that he was talking to a stranger. What had he been about to say? All at once I had a really monstrous idea. I pushed it away. It went, but it was hard work pushing that idea, like pushing a piano, and I could still see its outlines in the shadows. I became aware that Lee was looking at me very closely, and I wondered how much of what I had been thinking showed on my face.
"Did you take Mr. LeBay's address?" she asked.
"No." I thought for a moment, and then remembered the funeral, which now seemed impossibly far back in time. "But I imagine the Libertyville American Legion post has it. They buried LeBay and contacted the brother. Why?" Lee only shook her head and went to the window, where she stood looking out into the blinding day. "Shank of the year," I thought randomly. She turned back to me, and I was struck by her beauty again, calm and undemanding, except for those high, arrogant cheekbones, the sort of cheekbones you might expect to see on a lady probably carrying a knife in her belt.
"You said you'd show me something," she said.
"What was it?" I nodded. There was no way to stop now. The chain reaction had started. There was no way to shut it down. "Go upstairs," I said. "My room's the second door on the left. Look in the third drawer of my dresser. You'll have to dig under some of my undies, but they won't bite." She smiled, only a little, but even a little was an improvement. "And what am I going to find, a baggie of dope?" "I gave that up last year," I said, smiling back. "Lewds this year. I financed my habit selling heroin down at the junior high." "What is it, really?" "Arnie's autograph," I said, "immortalized on plaster." His autograph? I nodded. In duplicate. She found them, and 5 minutes later, we were on the couch again, looking at two squares of plaster cast. They sat side by side on the glass-topped coffee table, slightly ragged on the sides, a little the worse for wear. Other names danced off into limbo on one of them. I had saved the casts, had even directed the nurse on where to cut them. Later, I had cut out the two squares, one from the right leg, one from the left. We looked at them silently. Arnie Cunningham, on the right. Arnie Cunningham, on the left. Lee looked at me, questioning and puzzled. Those are pieces of your... My casts, yeah. Is it a joke or something? No joke. I watched him sign both of them. Now that it was out, there was a queer kind of loosening, of relief. It was good to be able to share this. It had been on my mind for a long time, itching and digging away. But they don't look anything alike. You're telling me, I said. But Arnie isn't much like he used to be either. And it all goes back to that goddamn car. I poked savagely at the square of plaster on the left. That isn't his signature. I've known Arnie almost all my life. I've seen his homework papers. I've seen him send away for things. I've watched him endorse his paychecks. And that is not his signature. The one on the right, yes. This one, no. You want to do something for me tomorrow, Lee? What? I told her. She nodded slowly. For us. Huh? I'll do it for us, because we have to do something, don't we? Yes, I said. I guess so. You mind a personal question? She shook her head, her remarkable blue eyes never leaving mine. How have you been sleeping lately? Not so well, she said. Bad dreams. How about you? No, not so good. And then, because I couldn't help myself anymore, I put my hands on her shoulders and kissed her. There was a momentary hesitation, and I thought she was going to draw away. Then her chin came up, and she kissed me back, firmly and fully. Maybe it was sort of lucky at that, me being mostly immobilized. When the kiss was over, she looked into my eyes, questioning. Against the dreams, I said, thinking it would come out stupid and phony smooth, the way it looks on paper. But instead it sounded shaky and almost painfully honest. Against the dreams, she repeated gravely, as if it were a talisman. And this time she inclined her head toward me, and we kissed again with those two ragged squares of plaster staring up at us like blind white eyes with Arnie's name written across them. We kissed for the simple animal comfort that comes with animal contact. Sure of that. And something more, starting to be something more. And then we held each other without talking. And I don't think we were kidding ourselves about what was happening, at least not entirely. It was comfort, but it was also good old sex, full, ripe, and randy with teenage hormones. And maybe it had a chance to be something fuller and kinder than just sex. But there was something else in those kisses. I knew it, she knew it, and probably you do too. That other thing was a shameful sort of betrayal. I could feel 18 years of memories cry out. The ant farms, the chess games, the movies, the things he had taught me, the times I had kept him from getting killed. Except maybe in the end, I hadn't. Maybe I had seen the last of him, and a poor ragtag end at that, on Thanksgiving night when he brought me the turkey sandwiches and beer. I don't think it occurred to either of us that until then we had done nothing unforgivable to Arnie. Nothing that might anger Christine. But now, of course, we had. 44. Detective work. Well, when the pipeline gets broken, and I'm lost on the river bridge, I'm all cracked up on the highway and in the water's edge, medics come down the throughway ready to sew me up with a thread, and if I fall down dying, you know she's bound to put a blanket on my bed. Bob Dylan. What happened in the next 3 weeks or so was that Lee and I played detective, and we fell in love. She went down to the municipal offices the next day and paid 50 cents to have two papers Xeroxed. Those papers go to Harrisburg, but Harrisburg sends a copy back to the town. This time my family was home when Lee arrived. Ellie peeked in on us whenever she got the chance. She was fascinated by Lee,
and I was quietly amused when, about a week into the new year, she started wearing her hair tied back, as Lee did. I was tempted to get on her case about it, and withstood the temptation. Maybe I was growing up a little bit, but not enough to keep from sneaking one of her yodels when I saw one hidden behind the Tupperware bowls of leftovers in the refrigerators. Except for Ellie's occasional peeks, we had the living room mostly to ourselves that next afternoon, the 27th of December, after the social amenities had been observed. I introduced Lee to my mother and father. My mom served coffee, and we talked. Elaine talked the most, chattering about her school and asking Lee all sorts of questions about art. At first I was annoyed, and then I was grateful. Both my parents are the soul of middle-class politeness. If my mom was being led to the electric chair and bumped into the chaplain, she would excuse herself. And I felt pretty clearly that they liked Lee. But it was also obvious, to me at least, that they were puzzled and a little uncomfortable, wondering where Arnie fit into all this, which was what Lee and I were wondering ourselves, I guess. Finally, they did what parents usually do when they're puzzled in such situations. They dismissed it as kid business and went about their own business. Dad excused himself first, saying that his workshop in the basement was in its usual post-Christmas shambles and he ought to start doing something about it. Mom said she wanted to do some writing. Ellie looked at me solemnly and said, "Dennis, did Jesus have a dog?" I cracked up, and so did Ellie. Lee sat watching us laugh, smiling politely, the way outsiders do when it's a family joke. "Split, Ellie," I said. "What'll you do if I won't?" she asked. But it was only routine brattiness. She was already getting up. "Make you wash my underwear," I said. "The hell you will," Ellie declared grandly, and left the room. "My little sister," I said. Lee was smiling. "She's great. If you had to live with her full time, you might change your mind. Let's see what you've got." Lee put one of the Xerox copies on the glass coffee table where the pieces of my casts had been yesterday. It was the re-registration of a used car, 1958 Plymouth sedan, four-door, red and white. It was dated November 1st, 1978, and signed Arnold Cunningham. His father had co-signed for him. Signature of owner, Arnold Cunningham. Signature of parent or guardian, if owner is under 18, Michael Cunningham. "What does that look like to you?" I asked. "One of the signatures on one of the squares you showed me," she said.
"Which one?"
"It's the way he signed just after I got crunched in Ridge Rock," I said. "It's the way his signature always looked. Now, let's see the other one." She put it down beside the first. This was a registration slip for a new car, 1958 Plymouth sedan, four-door, red and white. It was dated November 1st, 1957. I felt a nasty jolt at that exact similarity, and one look at Lee's face told me she had seen it too.
"Look at the signature," she said quietly.
I did. Signature of owner, Roland D. LeBay. Signature of parent or guardian, if owner is under 18, blank. This was the handwriting Arnie had used on Thanksgiving evening. You didn't have to be a genius or a handwriting expert to see that. The names were different, but the writing was exactly the same. Lee reached for my hands, and I took hers. What my father did in his basement workshop was make toys. I suppose that might sound a little weird to you, but it's his hobby, or maybe something more than a hobby. I think there might have been a time in his life when he had to make a difficult choice between going to college and going out on his own to become a toy maker. If that's true, then I guess he chose the safe way. Sometimes I think I see it in his eyes, like an old ghost not quite laid to rest. But that is probably only my imagination, which used to be a lot less active than it is now. Ellie and I were the chief beneficiaries, but Arnie had also found some of my father's toys under various Christmas trees and beside various birthday cakes, as had Ellie's closest childhood friend, Amy Carruthers, long since moved to Nevada, and now referred to in the doleful tones reserved for those who have died young and senselessly, and many other chums. Now my dad gave most of what he made to the Salvation Army 400 Fund, and before Christmas the basement always reminded me of Santa's workshop. Until just before Christmas, it would be filled with neat cardboard cartons containing wooden trains, little tool chests, erector set clocks that really kept time, stuffed animals, a small puppet theater or two. His main interest was in wooden toys, Up until the Vietnam War, he had made battalions of toy soldiers, but in the last 5 years or so, they had been quietly phased out. Even now, I'm not sure he was aware he was doing it. But like a good spray hitter, my dad went to all fields. During the week after Christmas, there was a hiatus. The workshop, which seemed terribly empty, with only the sweet smell of sawdust to remind us that the toys had ever been there. In that week, he would sweep, clean, oil his machinery, and get ready for next year. Then, as the winter wore on through January and February, the toys and the seeming junk that would become parts of toys would begin appearing again. Trains and jointed wooden ballerinas with red spots of color on their cheeks, a box of stuffing raked out of someone's old couch that would later end up in a bear's belly. My father called every one of his bears Owen or Olive. I had worn out 6 Owen bears between infancy and second grade, and Ellie had worn out a like number of Olive bears. Little snips of wire, buttons, and flat disembodied eyes scattered across the work table, like something out of a pulp horror story. Last, the liquor store boxes would appear, and the toys would again be packed into them. In the last 3 years, he had gotten 3 awards from the Salvation Army, but he kept them hidden away in a drawer, as if he was ashamed of them. I didn't understand it then, and don't now, not completely. But at least I know it wasn't shame. My father had nothing to be ashamed of. I worked my way down that evening after supper, clutching the banister madly with one arm and using my other crutch like a ski pole. "Dennis," he said, pleased but slightly apprehensive. "You need any help?" "No, I got it." He put his broom aside by a small yellow drift of shavings and watched to see if I was really going to make it. "How about a push, then?" "Ha, ha, very funny." I got down, semi-hopped over to the big easy chair my father keeps in the corner beside our old Motorola black and white, and sat down. Plonk. "How you doing?" he asked. "Pretty good." He brushed up a dustpan full of shavings, dumped them into his waste barrel, sneezed, and brushed up some more. "No pain?" "No. Well, some." "You want to be careful of stairs. If your mother had seen what you just did..." I grinned. "She'd scream, yeah." "Where is your mother?" "She and Ellie went over to the Renickies. Dinah Renicky got a complete library of Sean Cassidy albums for Christmas. Ellie is green." "I thought Sean was out," my father said. "I think she's afraid fashion might be doubling back on her." Dad laughed. Then there was a companionable silence for a while. Me sitting, him sweeping. I knew he'd get around to it, and presently he did. "Lee," he said, "used to go with Arnie, didn't she?" "Yes," I said. He glanced at me, then down at his work again. I thought he would ask me if I thought that was wise, or maybe mention that one fellow stealing another fellow's girl was not the best way to promote continued friendship and accord, but he said neither of those things. "We don't see much of Arnie anymore. Do you suppose he's ashamed of the mess he's in?" I had the feeling that my father didn't believe that at all, that he was simply testing the wind. "I don't know," I said. "I don't think he has much to worry about. With Darnell dead..." He tipped his dustpan into the barrel, and the shaving slid in with a soft flump. "I doubt if they'll even bother to prosecute." "No?" "Not Arnie, not on anything serious. He may be fined, and the judge will probably lecture him, but nobody wants to put an indelible black mark on the record of a nice young suburban white boy who is bound for college and a fruitful place in society." He shot me a sharp, questioning look, and I shifted in the chair, suddenly uncomfortable. "Yeah, I suppose. Except he's not really like that anymore, is he, Dennis?" "No, he's changed." "When was the last time you actually saw him?" "Thanksgiving." "Was he okay then?" I shook my head slowly, suddenly feeling like crying and blurting it all out. I had felt that way once before, and hadn't. I didn't this time either, but for a different reason. I remembered what Lee had said about being nervous for her parents on Christmas Eve. And it seemed to me now that the fewer the people who knew about our suspicions, the safer for them. "What's wrong with him?" "I don't know." "Does Lee?" "No, not for sure. We have some suspicions." "Do you want to talk about them?" "Yes. In a way I do. But I think it would be better if I didn't." "All right," he said, "for now." He swept the floor.
The sound of the hard bristles on the concrete was almost hypnotic.
And maybe you had better talk to Arnie before too much longer.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. But it wasn't an interview I looked forward to.
There was another period of silence. Dad finished sweeping and then glanced around.
Looks pretty good, huh?
Great, Dad.
He smiled a little sadly and lit a Winston. Since his heart attack, he had given the butts up almost completely, but he kept a pack around, and every now and then he'd have one, usually when he felt under stress.
Bullshit. It looks empty as hell.
Well, yeah.
You want a hand upstairs, Dennis?
I got my crutches under me.
I wouldn't turn it down.
He looked at me and snickered. Long John Silver, all you need is the parrot.
Are you going to stand there giggling or give me a hand?
Give you a hand, I guess.
I slung an arm over his shoulder, feeling somehow like a little kid again.
It brought back almost forgotten memories of him carrying me upstairs to bed on Sunday nights, after I started to doze off halfway through the Ed Sullivan show. The smell of his aftershave was just the same.
At the top, he said, "Step on me if I'm getting too personal, Denny, but Lee's not going with Arnie anymore, is she?"
"No, Dad."
"Is she going with you?"
I don't really know. I guess not."
"Not yet, you mean?"
"Well, yeah, I guess so."
I was starting to feel uncomfortable, and it must have showed, but he pushed on anyway.
"Would it be fair to say that maybe she broke it off with Arnie because he wasn't the same person anymore?"
"Yes, I think that would be fair to say."
"Does he know about you and Lee?"
"Dad, there's nothing to know. At least not yet."
He cleared his throat, seemed to consider, and then said nothing. I let go of him and worked at getting my crutches under me. I worked a little harder at it than I had to, maybe.
"I'll give you a little gratuitous advice," my father said finally.
"Don't let him know what's between you and her. And never mind the protestations that there isn't anything. You're trying to help him some way, aren't you?"
"I don't know if there's anything either Lee or I can do for Arnie, Dad."
"I've seen him two or three times," my father said.
"You have?" I said, startled. "Where?"
My father shrugged. "On the street, downtown. You know, Libertyville's not that big, Dennis.
He what?"
"Hardly seemed to recognize me.
And he looks older.
Now that his face is cleared, he looks much older. I used to think he took after his father, but now..."
He broke off suddenly. "Dennis, has it occurred to you that Arnie may be having some sort of nervous breakdown?"
"Yes," I said, and only wished I could have told him that there were other possibilities, worse ones, possibilities that would have made my old man wonder if I was the one having a nervous breakdown.
"You be careful," he said, and although he didn't mention what had happened to Will Darnell, I suddenly felt strongly that he was thinking of it. "You be careful, Dennis."
Lee called me on the telephone the next day and said her father was being called away to Los Angeles on year-end business and had proposed on the spur of the moment that they all go along with him and get away from the cold and the snow. "My mother was crazy about the idea, and I just couldn't think of any plausible reason to say no," she said. "It's only 10 days, and school doesn't start again until January 8th.
"It sounds great," I said. "Have fun out there."
"You think I should go?"
"If you don't, you ought to have your head examined."
"Dennis?"
"What?"
Her voice dropped a little.
"You'll be careful, won't you? I've been thinking about you a lot lately."
She hung up then, leaving me feeling surprised and warm. But the guilt remained, fading a little now, maybe, but still there. My father had asked me if I was trying to help Arnie. Was I? Or was I maybe only snooping into a part of his life which he had expressly marked off-limits, and stealing his girl in the process? And what exactly would Arnie do or say if he found out? My head ached with questions, and I thought that maybe it was just as well that Lee was going away for a while. As she herself had said about our folks, it seemed safer. On Friday the 29th, the last business day of the old year, I called the Libertyville American Legion post and asked for the secretary. I got his name, Richard McCandless, from the building's janitor, who also found a telephone number to go with it.
The number turned out to be that of David Emerson's, Libertyville's good furniture store. End of side 10. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.